I've thought a lot about the idea of vulnerability. It comes from like a root word that means able to be wounded. And yet I think that same capacity to be wounded is related to the capacity to receive love. And that if we are not able to be vulnerable with one another, then we cut ourselves off from, I guess, like whatever the truest parts of who we are, of what we need, and of what we have to offer.
Amy Julia Becker is an award-winning writer and speaker on personal, spiritual, and social healing. She's the author of 4 books, including To Be Made Well, An Invitation to Wholeness, Healing, and Hope, releasing in March. She also hosts the Love is Stronger Than Fear podcast. A graduate of Princeton University and Princeton Theological Seminary, Becker holds a bivocational license with Evangelical Covenant Church. She lives with her husband and their 3 children in Western Connecticut, and we speak with her today about her experience parenting one of her children and what that child's disability has taught her about the meaning of grace and our vulnerability before God and each other. I'm Matthew Wickman, Founding Director of the BYU Humanities Center. So Amy Julia Becker, welcome and thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you on the podcast. I ask my guests how faith figures into their life and work. But let me take a step back or two, step or two back, and ask you a preliminary question, maybe even 2 questions. Now, you're a writer with several books to your name and a new one set to appear in just a couple of months. I guess my first question is, how did you come to be a writer? And perhaps more meaningfully, how did you come to write about what you describe on your website as personal, spiritual, and social healing? Like why work on this subject in this way, creative nonfiction, and not some other way?
Sure. So in some ways, I took a back door into the writing world. I can look back at my childhood and say I was always writing poetry and writing short stories and writing essays and things like that. But I didn't have a vision for a career as a writer, even as an English major in college. That didn't cross my mind as a possibility. And I was in a parachurch youth ministry, actually, right out of college, and was going to Princeton Seminary to get a Master's of Divinity, which was kind of a logical next step. And my mother-in-law was diagnosed with primary liver cancer. And so my husband and I were in this transition phase where we had a couple months off. And so we ended up becoming her primary caregivers through that time. And I journaled so much about that experience simply as a way to process it myself. But then as a result of all of that, I deferred a semester of seminary and we moved and she died. And so I was somewhat alone with all of these thoughts and honestly all of these words in this journal, waiting for school to start. And I spent a couple of months just typing up those journals. And the way it felt to me was that the names in the journals, like those characters, started to talk. So I worked on a book, this is now almost 20 years ago, over the course of my time in seminary, that helped me recognize this is what I want to be doing. And honestly, this is even what I want to be doing from a position of ministry. And so that led into the next book, which was a memoir about our daughter Penny, who was diagnosed with Down syndrome a few hours after she was born. That led into the next. And in terms of the topic of healing, in some ways that was retrospective, right? Like looking back over these disparate memoir, creative nonfiction works that I've written, seeing that there really is a through line. And it has to do with, on the one hand, what does it mean to be human? And also what does it mean to be both broken and beloved, vulnerable and gifted? How do we hold those things together? And so there are these themes of disability and of faith and of healing that really come up throughout all of that. And so that's how I ended up in this place and writing about these things.
Yeah, being broken and beloved, that's a really beautiful formulation. And you address it, I think, so wonderfully in your work. I mean, I came across your work first in this great essay in Plow Quarterly, we talked about in a few minutes. But then I bought one of your books, White Picket Fences, which is also just a beautiful, beautiful book That was published in 2018, and it's this really sensitive account of coming to terms with your own whiteness and the privilege that that whiteness bestows, and also the barriers in some ways that privilege presents to our efforts to heal, and as a society, and even personally. Now, I'm curious, were you writing that book today after so much additional attention has been brought to the pervasive nature of racism in our country, right, through the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others? Would this book, White Picket Fences, be different, or would you write the very same book today if you were writing it again?
Such a good question. And so in some ways, the book that's coming out in March, which is called To Be Made Well, is the book I would write today on these topics, because on the one hand, it is talking more about a personal experience of even bodily healing, like what happens when our bodies feel bad and how do we deal with shame and things like that. But it's also talking about the work of healing in our society and the way in which actually an encounter with Jesus as a healer is holistic. And so that doesn't just mean mind, body, spirit as individuals, but actually community and society and world as well. So in some ways, that is the book that I wrote in response to the events of the last couple of years, both personally and socially. I also, though, would say I have learned so much since White Picket Fences came out. And that was true even before 2020 and the racial reckoning that happened in our country at that time, that I was learning just from having put the book out into the world and listening to people and hearing back from people. But then it all the more so was true once George Floyd was murdered, and the other events you mentioned also were just kind of catalyzing consciousness among people I knew, within myself. So in some ways it would be different, but in some ways it would be so different that it would be a different book, which is what I wrote.
Yeah, so. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to reading that book. I will say one of the things I really loved about White Picket Fences is that you see, it's not a book that's written once you've arrived at ultimate or complete wisdom. It's right. A book where you really see a lot of these ideas in formation. But it's recounted so sensitively and so insightfully. There's some just fantastic insights in there, mm-hmm. and you kind of feel them born at the moment of writing, which I really appreciated. It was beautifully done. So let me circle back to the question I usually begin with in these podcasts, yeah. and ask it very straightforwardly now. So, how does faith figure into your life and work?
Well, pretty directly. I feel like I have. There's some part of me that aspires to be more subtle about my faith. I really admire writers where you have a hint that there is some grounding in spiritual truth and in an understanding of a God of grace. And it's almost like, ooh, I found there was like this mysterious plot line and it got revealed all at the end, or even it didn't. And I can only see it once I really think about these subtle clues along the way. And I don't know how to do that. And this is true. I mean, my husband's like, oh my gosh, take her to a dinner party and she's going to be in the corner talking about like how she can pray for someone. So I would not mind being more subtle about the fact that I really, nevertheless, I do feel like I've been given a desire to talk with people about the fact that I have just loved getting to know God over the course of my life. And no, I don't have all the answers, but I really love reading the Bible and I love thinking about and talking about the stories there. And I love learning from people who don't believe the same things that I believe, but I really love those ultimate questions, those big questions, and being able to communicate about them, certainly through writing, also through speaking, teaching, podcasting, you know, that brings great joy to me. And I believe it has been a blessing to some people as well. I certainly hope so.
It seems like it, yeah. I mean, the book that you wrote, the book I read, White Picket Fences, is full of great endorsers. So a lot of people clearly have read that book, and I was moved by it. What I love about people who are writers of faith, I love it when people's faith makes them more and not less human, right? Mm. More in touch with deep questions and the things that connect us across our differences, and not more buried in their own enclaves of belief with a small group. That's why so many of these podcasts are really ecumenical in nature. It's It's me talking across to people who share things in common, but also different perspectives. That's what I love. And your work really exemplifies that.
Oh, thank you. I agree. I think that sense of there's still a lot of mystery. There are a lot of questions. There's a lot of expansive possibility in terms of both who God is and who we are as humans, and hoping that, yes, there's a lot of space for that. That would definitely be my, I wouldn't have necessarily thought to put it that way, but that would be so much my desire in what I'm writing and thinking about, is to be able to communicate that, but also, I guess, and this goes back to the idea of what it means to be human as people who give and receive love, that there's a mutuality in our exchanges, and that's true whether or not we believe the same things, that there's not a hierarchy, that because I have been to seminary, I know more, or I have more to offer. I have something to offer when it comes to, I studied that thing and I might know something you don't. But if I can come into any exchange with a posture of humility, where I assume that I also have something that I need to receive from whoever I'm encountering, and that I also have something to give. So there's like a humility and a confidence in trusting our humanity in that sense of mutuality.
Yeah, that's great. That may be my favorite part of the book, White Picket Fences, is your reflections there on what it means to be human. That to be human is the capacity to receive and give love. And you talk about it in relation to your daughter, Penny, in that book. And that's good segue, because let's turn now, if we can, to your essay titled When Merit Drives Out Grace. And it's about your daughter. I'm curious when you decided to write this essay, and how did it wind up in Plow Quarterly, which is where I read it?
Yeah, it's a great story. It was good to reflect back on this, because I actually wrote the beginnings of that essay also as a journal entry. So in 2019, my husband was given a mini sabbatical from work. So we had from Thanksgiving break through the new year, so about 6 weeks to do whatever we wanted as a family. And we decided to travel. And so we pulled our kids out of school and we traveled. 1 week of that break was we were traveling in an RV in national parks in California. So we were in Yosemite in December. So it was like 22 degrees during the night, you know, and maybe in the 30s during the day. So it was cold, and we were in, all five of us in an RV together. And our daughter Penny has Down syndrome. And so she probably was, I guess, 13 at the time. And she definitely is not someone who wants to move quickly through the world. She does not love hiking. She does not love the cold. And we, as a result, sometimes all slowed down and did these various walks and hikes together. And sometimes I would say to the rest of the family, or my husband would, you guys go ahead, I'm going to stay with Penny. And as we were walking, I really was thinking about the idea of, okay, what am I sacrificing, so to speak, by slowing down here? And am I gaining anything? And there was a part of me that expected the story to go like this. I slow down and I notice the owl, or we see the elk, and the rest of the family that's scurrying ahead, they miss out. And none of that happened. Like, we missed out on the beautiful views, right? And so it really struck me in that time that what I gained was time with my daughter. That was it. Like, she was the reward. Love was the reward. And so I was just contemplating that over the course of really the next couple of weeks. And when I came back from that time, I was able to kind of, with that story or that moment of recognition and realization as a centerpiece, think about what's at stake here. Like, what is going on here when it comes to love, when it comes to slowing down and attending to the people and not just the production. And that led me into ideas around the meritocracy and grace and some of the other themes of the essay. And then I had a really, really hard time finding anyone who wanted to publish it, honestly. So I do not need to go through the various publications that said, no, thank you. Or that doesn't really fit us here. That doesn't really fit us there. And so finally, actually, when I was selling the book To Be Made Well, Plow publishing, the book side of it, said no to that book, but they said, do you have any essays that you might want to submit to the journal? And I did. So that was about a year ago. And it took a while to come into its final form and then finally be published. But yeah, it's been 2 years in the making, and that's how it ended up in those pages.
It's a great story about being in Yosemite and that realization, because there is such a kind of a romantic idea that somehow if we slow down, suddenly we perceive so many things. And that really, as you point out, and you mentioned also in the essay, right? But it can be a paradigm change, right, for how what it is we're trying to value, and not kind of like the grasping after experience, really the consumption of experience, almost consumer-like consumption of experiences. Mm-hmm. Instead, no, it's not about that. It really is about relationship, which is what you come to in this essay. Again, it's a beautiful essay. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that Plow published it. Now, the essay is structured in three parts, and I'll ask you a question or two about all three of the parts.
Sure.
By way of overview of the essay as a whole, you discuss the problems with our meritocratic system, the meritocracy, right? Then you talk about the experiencing of parenting a child with Down syndrome. And then you conclude with some moral and religious reflections on what living with Penny teaches you about life's priorities. So let's begin with the first part of the essay on the problems of the meritocracy. How would you summarize for us the problems of meritocracy to kind of a couple essential points?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the meritocracy is this idea that anyone who works hard has an opportunity to essentially gain social stability, both by way of status and wealth and education. And even let's assume for a minute that that is true. There's some reasons to think it's not true, that everyone gets what they deserve from a meritocratic basis. But nevertheless, even if it does, what it still puts us in is a system of valuing hard work and achievement above anything else, and saying that those are the things that are worthy of stability as a human. Those are the things that will get you money and safety and healthcare and all of these things. So there are, you know, some problems with that simply from a what does it mean to value every human perspective. But then there also are problems. I mean, I am firmly located within the meritocracy as an educated, affluent white woman who comes from generations of similar folks. And I have noticed, especially because I think of having Penny in my life, the degree to which the society that I live in has some deep problems that are actually linked to those same ideas that if I just work hard enough, then I will be valuable. And those ideas show up whether it's in teenage substance use and abuse or in adult substance use and abuse, in high rates of anxiety and depression. You know, if we think about even the scandals like the Varsity Blues scandal, the college admission scandal from a couple of years ago, these incredibly wealthy parents who, again, have quote unquote everything they might need, who are trying to buy their kids' way into college. Or whether we think about just looking at the rate of suicide among young people is not typically something that is different depending on your economic stability in our country. And so you can look at these things and say, there's something wrong here, that people are so unhappy with when they've quote unquote gotten to the top. Shouldn't this be the place where you're actually great, I'm good now? And it's like, no, this is still not working. So there's a problem in terms of, you know, who belongs in the meritocracy for sure, but there's also a problem within it because of that sense of we only value you if you continue to prove yourself by working harder and harder and harder.
These are great points. You know, that point, I was thinking when I read your essay, a couple of things about that I loved in this section, right, is the point you make that the meritocracy is just kind of a new form of aristocracy, right, that advantages of birth still really overwhelmingly predict success as our society measures things. But also that those who are inside the meritocracy, who are the beneficiaries of it, don't necessarily live fulfilling lives. They're on this hamster wheel of around and around and more production and more, you know, accumulation of resources and blah, blah, blah. That it's not that satisfying. When you look around at a lot of the social discussion around inequality, which is such an important discussion to have, do you find that discussion to be sufficiently nuanced in the ways that it imagines equality? Is it equality at the human level, or is it equality of resources? Because those are different things, right? And I've asked myself sometimes, are we trying to achieve the right things when we bring attention to inequality? I mean, we must bring attention to inequality. That must happen. Is there another step to take, though, to bring attention to what it means even to live a full, fulfilling life that we miss somehow sometimes in that discussion?
Yes. I mean, I agree with you. So it is really important to shine a light on the fact that we have unequal systems and practices. And I think we do have data that suggests, and I think this is compelling, that there is a certain economic threshold that you have to meet in order to not just be in survival mode. But it's a relatively low one when we look at the degree of income disparity in our country. I mean, I think it's a household income below $100,000 that is like, yeah, we feel safe and stable and we can put food on the table. And after that, happiness is not really doesn't go along with more money. In fact, that's where comparison sets in this whole cycle. In all of those cases, however, to your point, that sense of what is it that we value is an important question. And for me, again, having my daughter Penny in my life really changed things, because for a long time after Penny was born, I found myself advocating for her and for other kids with disabilities or with other kind of forms of vulnerability in the world. But what I was really doing was saying, hey, I want you to be able to come be like me. I want you to have access to everything that I have. And essentially, I was saying, my life is the standard, and I want you to be able to have the same standard. And over time, I began to recognize, like, wait a second, what if there's some really valuable things that you, Penny, or other people with intellectual disabilities, or a whole range of other, you know, kind of demographic descriptions, what if there are things that I need to learn from you? What if there are ways in which I need to be shaped and changed and formed? And what if that means letting go of some of the things that I think are so valuable, whether that is social status or wealth or even education, even to some degree, hard work? What if I need to let go of some of these values in order to receive a deeper understanding, back to what we were saying before, of what it means to be human and of what it means to be someone who can give and receive love? So I think that conversation about who and what we value and why is really at the root of this conversation, and even the conversation about equality, that it does not get addressed very often.
Yeah, I agree. And I find that problematic. And you bring out, I think, beautifully, you know, what parenting a child with a disability has done to sort of really kind of expand your view of what it means to be human, of what a fulfilled life is and means. You know, you talk about how caring for Penny requires you to slow down. You told that great story about being with the family in Yosemite and being forced to slow down, and I can't see the beautiful views, you know, they all saw El Cap and I didn't, you know, whatever. There's this part of section two of your essay here. I'll quote it to you. You say that, I'm quoting you, "I still find myself resisting what Penny nevertheless has begun to teach me. A new way of being in time, a way of waiting, of slowing down, a way that privileges place over speed and relationships over productivity." You know, it's such an important point. But as you point out here, though, it's not one you can just kind of get one day in an epiphany and you're done. How long has this point been distilling on you, and how is your life different, say now 10 years later, from what it might have been early at an earlier phase of this coming to this lesson?
Yeah, I mean, I think for any parent or any person who's been in a caregiving role, there's some measure of this quote unquote lesson or even paradigm shift that's going to happen, that caring for other people does require slowing down, even just in a friendship, of course, like listening to someone and pausing to do that. But especially when you don't get to choose the time frame for that slowing, whether that's because you're up in the middle of the night or because you, you know, are in the middle of the day and get a call that your kid is sick at school or whatever. And then with disability, that tends to elongate the period of more direct caregiving, whether that's, you know, in Penny's case, she walked when she was 2 years old, but I was still needing to just physically carry her places that I did not need to with her typical siblings when they were her same age. And, you know, you can kind of spread that out over many aspects of her development, that it literally took longer. And there was a slowness to her development and to her growth in the world that, again, was somewhat challenged by our society, because we like to move fast and we have developmental charts and goals and milestones, and we're supposed to be meeting them and our kids are supposed to be meeting them. And there's some sense of being a good parent when we do meet and achieve them. So there's a lot of, you know, mental shifting that needed to happen for me as her mom early on. Now, I think it's, for example, for Penny to, she would really like to live independently one day. For her to do that requires some learning that, again, just takes more time. So learning how to cook a meal, both because she's physically small, and so there's some modifications in our kitchen that are necessary for her to be able to do it, but also her hands are smaller and less strong. So it's like, oh, we need to buy a different set of knives in order for you to do this by yourself. And I need to say, instead of dinner taking a half an hour where I'm just like quickly getting through it, we're going to really take the time, and that's going to be longer. And I'm going to change my, I guess, my heart towards that, because this is, yeah, it's about cooking dinner. There's a productive value here, and that's not a bad thing, but it's also about engaging with you and loving you and trusting that this is worth it, that whatever is happening here over time is worth it and is ultimately transforming me also into a person who's more capable of love, not just in this moment, but in a broader sense, and not just love for other people, but honestly, love and grace for myself as well. Because I think one of the things that comes from being someone who is, you know, by virtue of my own genetic code or whatever, able to get things done quickly and on time and, you know, productively in the world, is that I can be incredibly hard on myself and on other people. And what does it mean for me to learn in that slowing down, to live within good human limits, to need other people, to have grace for myself and for others? Those are all the types of things that have begun to shift in me, but that I'm constantly relearning all the same.
Absolutely. No, I have got two daughters, and neither one has Down syndrome. But I have had to learn, in their case, to be able to accommodate their own needs to slow down. I mean, one of them has anxiety and wanted to kind of just get off the hamster wheel for a while. And the other one has had some pretty severe chronic illnesses, and that really slowed her down. And she was a very precocious child, and then found herself needing to slow down because her body wouldn't allow her to kind of go at the pace she'd been going at. And it really brought attention to me to how all of us, in some ways, develop more slowly in areas than others around us. In some ways, those closest to us. And have you noticed as much in yourself? Have you said to yourself, you know, in working with your daughter over the years, you know, this is, here's where Penny is slow, and over here is where I might be slow, but the point is not speed in the first place?
That's a great question. I mean, I would say that I am slow to learn grace and love, and that that actually is not true for her. That there is a more instinctive, I mean, she has a gift of encouragement, but also of, I don't know, care or and concern for people. And I can cut that off pretty easily. I mean, I don't know if I learned to cut it off, and I had it at one point, but certainly by the time I was 16, which is how old Penny is now, I was pretty able to keep myself going, and in part by not paying attention to needs, whether that was my own needs or the needs of people around me. So I do think I was slow to learn that. And I also think, though, I love the grace embedded in your question, that even that speed is not the point there either, but there is a sense of, you know, this is this is a journey, and we do are, I think, essentially asked to take the next small step, but not to race forward or be in some competitive race with each other as we get there.
That's right. Yeah. Because going back to your point earlier, I mean, what if the point is relationship? You know, but here on this journey we're on is relationship with each other, relationship with God, and not necessarily how quickly we become our most perfected selves. Somehow that drive for perfectibility can become toxic and become really contrary to the very idea of grace that you talk about in this essay.
Well, and I think within that, I at least had as a Christian, like an understanding of perfectibility before Penny was in my life, as if I was going to be an autonomous and like fully self-sufficient human. So seeing perfectibility as this almost like becoming superwoman as an isolated individual. And that's so in contrast to this idea of mutuality and giving and receiving and understanding human limitation and really recognizing that need, I think from a like biblical perspective, need is a part of what it means to be human, even in our most perfect state, because that's what allows us to relate to one another and to God. And so it's really a different understanding of human perfection that does not imply individualism and does not imply being able to do everything for myself, which I think I kind of implicitly was living like, you know, for a long time.
That's a great point and beautifully put. Thank you. What would you say then to people who want it all? Okay, they want speed and achievement, but also want relationship. I mean, can we have both?
I mean, yes and no, right? So I don't think it is bad. My husband and I talk about this sometimes. He said to me the other day, he's like, but I really like going fast. And he was talking about running. Like he actually really likes running. And I thought, yeah, you know, and there's some goodness to that. Like it's not and some goodness to the fact that I really like writing stuff and I like writing it well, and I will work hard to do that. But there is a relationship, I think, between when we're doing those, that hard work and the joy that it brings and the goodness and the beauty. I mean, there's some relationship between those things, as opposed to it simply being a matter of proving myself or striving or some sort of, you know, external motivation. But I still think that, yeah, like I have had to slow down as a mom and as a mother of 3 children, as a mother of a child with a disability over the course of the past 16 years. And certainly, like, I would have written more books and I would have been on more podcasts and I would have, like, there's so much more I would have done. And so the slowing down was necessary to the relationships with my kids. But it doesn't mean that it's an either or, that all I got was relationship with my children and I, you know, had to, I don't know, sacrifice all of my dreams or something. But there, I do think that to move in that relational sense through the world is going to take time, and that is going to affect productivity in a pretty direct way.
Yeah. Well put. Thank you. You know, I love a point you make in your essay's concluding section, the third section. I'm quoting here from that section. You write, Penny was diagnosed with a disability when she was born, and I still use that word, disability, to describe her condition, because it is the easiest way to convey the truth that she moves and learns and processes information more slowly than typical kids. And yet, the word that seems more appropriate as a descriptor of Penny's experience of the world is vulnerable. Okay, not disabled, but vulnerable. I thought that was a really lovely insight. Can you comment on that insight?
Yeah, you know, that was really something that was given to me a long time ago, probably by a guy named Thomas Reynolds, who wrote a book called Vulnerable Communion about his own child with a disability. And since then, I've thought a lot about the idea of vulnerability. It comes from like a root word that means able to be wounded. And yet I think that same capacity to be wounded is related to the capacity to receive love. And that if we are not able to be vulnerable with one another, then we cut ourselves off from, I guess, like whatever the truest parts of who we are, of what we need and of what we have to offer. And so there's something that can feel very intimate for sure. Like you don't want to be vulnerable unless you're safe, because you'll be wounded, right? And for someone like Penny, that's not necessarily a choice that she gets to make in the world in the same way that I do. And yet, even in the safest places when we're vulnerable, love will bring wounding, whether that's because of loss, you know, because of actual death, or just because of experiencing and caring for the heartbreak of the people that we do love. So I think that sense of physical vulnerability, emotional, spiritual, you know, all of the different aspects of who we are, Penny, having her in my life and recognizing her vulnerability did really prompt me to try to ask myself the question, how much have I tried to guard myself from being vulnerable over the, you know, over the years? In what ways have I armored up, to use Brené Brown's term? And what would it mean to be able to put down that armor, and to really identify the habits, the patterns that I've established to try to keep myself from being wounded? But in what ways has that also kept me from being able to be a participant in love?
It's such an important question. And that's a difficult set of questions to ask yourself. At least has been for me to ask myself. You know, yeah. As a scholar, I would not say that vulnerability is the posture preferred by most scholars. You know, and you know this from your own experience in education. You know, there really is kind of an indomitability about imagining you know things and therefore you're in control of things. You control discourses. If you control discourses, you can control resources at universities. You can get your work out there. You can, and to be vulnerable and admit, I don't know. Or maybe even in this case, knowing alone is not sufficient to doing anything meaningful with what I know. And I've been asking myself those questions much more rigorously, strenuously, and in some cases painfully the last few years. And to see you give voice to it in the essay and then here in the podcast is I really appreciate it, because I think you put your finger on something so important here, and you do so in a really articulate way. I also got to say, this is an aside, I really appreciate how you mentioned that your daughter still has moral failings. I'm quoting from your essay again. Yeah, it's great. You say, she spends hours on her recently acquired iPhone scrolling through Instagram. You know, she rolls her eyes at me when I suggest you turn off YouTube and enjoy the sunshine. She often insists on her own way, especially when it comes to watching a movie. You know, I've got a sister who has developmental disabilities, and I could make a list of my own, you know, call them petty shortcomings that I've seen her have. And a lot of them are the same as your daughter. So you aren't romanticizing Penny as a more perfected being, but the world in which she lives is nonetheless a gentler world. It's a less punishing world. It's less punishing of herself and others. And that's really, I think, the virtue in that life.
Mm. Yeah, I love your words, less punishing and gentler. Those are very much true. One of the things we often talk about in our family is that Penny will get upset about something and she'll often cover her face, and then pretty soon she'll be laughing. Like, it's just like she can't hold it that long, because I mean, it's just not that important. And not, again, to be dismissive of her real feelings, which she certainly will express if she needs to, but at the same time, there is a sense of like a lightness of spirit that she can bring into situations where her siblings cannot. I mean, and they would say this, that they are, I mean, Penny has never run out of the room in tears, and the rest of them have, you know, and there's just a sense of, as you said, like gentler and less punishing, which is really admirable and necessary. And I found that, you know, that's not something that she will necessarily be commended for by most people. Most people won't notice that, or even necessarily think of it as positive, but we certainly need a gentler and less punishing world, and I'm glad she's in it to help remind me of that.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned that you've adopted a practice of silent meditation every morning, sometimes for 20 minutes, sometimes longer, and you acknowledge that this is rarely simply a peaceful experience, right? That silence can be which comes from slowing down, making yourself mm-hmm. slow down, that silence can be painful, difficult, terrifying. Can you describe that experience about how you came to have this practice and what your experience of it has been?
Yeah, I should probably, you know, spend some time looking back in my journals in terms of how it all came to be. But I know that in the past 10 years, I've read enough spiritual writers who I admire who've mentioned taking, in many cases, like 20 minutes twice a day to sit in silence and meditate. And I thought, oh my gosh, like, what is this? But enough people, men, women from 50 years ago, from the contemporary moment, you know, who are talking about this, who I really admire, I should probably try it. And so it was like, well, what do I do? I mean, I just sit there, like, what is this? Is it prayer? I know how to like list out the things that I'm praying for, whether that's myself or someone else. I know confession, I know Thanksgiving, I know all of these things. Like, what is this silence? I mean, and I literally like read books about this that did not necessarily answer my questions about what it is. But what I have come to is a couple of different things. On days when I'm feeling particularly scattered, I will have probably what is more akin to prayer. I will still set a timer for anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes, you know, depending on all sorts of factors. And sometimes I'll literally be like, okay, as I inhale, I'm breathing in peace. And as I exhale, I'm giving God my worries. And I might think pretty specifically about what those worries are. Other times when I'm able to, I can do more of that continuously coming back to one word or phrase. So love, belonging, beloved, peace, joy, you know, something along those lines. And it really does just depend on my own state of mind and heart as I enter into that place. But I would say that most of the time I am more distracted than I am attending to whatever the word or phrase is. And I am feeling impatient and wondering when that little ding on my phone is going to come and let me return to my day. And so it often feels like that was a waste. Like, why did I even do it if I was going to be so distracted the whole time? But I also believe that it has, over time, now many years, been transformative for my soul, so that I'm more attentive to my body during the day. I'm more attentive to emotions. I'm more attentive to slowing down, to the people around me. So I think my struggle to essentially center my attention on one truth about who God is, I struggle to do that for 5 minutes or 20 minutes or something in between, nevertheless does ripple out into the other, you know, 20, almost 24 hours of the day where I am so likely to be distracted by so many things. And yet I know it does give me more attentiveness to the spirit of God in me and around me throughout the day.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I relate to it. I don't have quite the same practice that you described, though it's close. I mean, for me, it's more like prayerful contemplation, but it is extended, and it's a lot of it involves sitting quietly, listening, reflecting, pondering, and working through a lot of my own agitation. You know, like, why do I feel so unable to sit still right now? Why do I feel so unable to concentrate? And that does have an effect on me, at least throughout the remainder of the day, and it's made me a more, I think, mindful, attentive person. So thank you. A couple more questions. We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you two questions here. You have this book coming out in just a couple months. Is it at all an elaboration on the ideas you explore in the essay we discussed this morning, or is it a different book?
It is an elaboration, although not directly, I would say. So this book is called To Be Made Well, An Invitation to Wholeness, Healing, and Hope. And it is looking at the story from Mark's gospel about Jesus and Jairus and the bleeding woman. Mm. So it's a healing story in those gospels. And it's looking at the holistic nature of healing, mind, body, spirit, and community. What keeps us from healing? And that's where some of these same things we've been talking about, distraction, shame, injustice, there's something else that I write about that keep us from healing. And Oh, fear and anxiety. And then the final part is, what does it look like for us to be invited to participate in healing personally and in our world? So, you know, there's stories about Penny, there's comment on the anxiety that comes from being within the meritocracy. There's certainly a kind of a meditation on love, and even some writing about the contemplative practices that can help us to participate in healing. But it is not, it's definitely not quite the same as the essay.
Yeah. Okay. It sounds like an amazing book. I mean, these are important topics, obviously, but you also write about these kinds of things just really, really beautifully in a very humane way, which I look forward to reading it. Last question though, is this one, right? So you've written several books and you're obviously a very thoughtful person. Is there a book you would like to write that you feel is somehow still a little beyond your capacity or experience?
So it's interesting. I mean, I actually would like to write a book that is more directly related to the themes in this essay. So that's kind of percolating. But I also have a list in my head, not on paper, but a list of ideas for novels that probably go back to the very beginning of this conversation and my lack of subtlety when it comes to faith. Because I think it's, I don't know, I feel like novels in particular really shine when, if you are coming at it from a perspective of faith, that needs to really not be heavy-handed at all. And I don't know, the combination of I have a hard time imagining characters that aren't me and the people I already know, which can get me into trouble. And also, I haven't done it before. So it would be a big risk to try to do it. But I do have some plot lines or characters who kind of are, you know, yeah, they seem out of reach for me in terms of my writing ability, but also like it might be a good risk to take someday.
Yeah, sure. That sounds exciting. Well, it's such a pleasure to talk with you. And it was a pleasure for me to prep for this interview by reading your work. Thank you for what you've written, and all the best to you as you continue in your important work.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been delightful to talk with you today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.